walking forward.
Okay. Mountains. All right. I'll take this as we go along. That's fine. Exam 2 is next Monday. What's the date next Monday? November 2nd. Yeah. All right. Covering chapters 4, 5, and 6 through today's lecture. Okay. So anything we cover through today is fair game for the exam. I'm telling you about this exam that's coming up on Monday. I think. Yeah, that's something you might want to pay attention to. So, 4, 5, and 6. Yeah, let's do that. Up through today's lecture. So there is chapter 6. Mastering Chemistry, which is available right now. As of now, it was due Friday, but we're not going to get through everything we need to do that assignment on Friday. So that assignment will be due next Friday, which is November 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Six.
Next Friday, November 6th, but you should still do appropriate problems for exam studying. Okay, so. You're not off the hook. It is a terrible idea to save that entire assignment for next week. There will be questions on the exam on Monday, which will be similar to those to some of those on this Chapter 6 assignment. So go through that assignment. What I'll probably do after class today, I'll make a little note in there saying that questions above this are fair for the exam. Questions below this will be covered on the next exam. So, it's not going to be due until next Friday. But if you're serious about doing well on this exam, it would be to your benefit to get those appropriate problems done before the exam. Does that make sense? Okay. Studying for the exam should be a similar ordeal to the first one. You know, I assign all those end of chapter problems in the textbook, and the questions on my exam are usually very similar to a lot of those. That's where I get a lot of inspiration for exam questions. So practice those kind of things. The only ones I've assigned are ones that have answers in the back of the textbook. So practice the problem, and once you get an answer, go check the back of the textbook to see if you did it right. Okay. Yeah. Let's see here. What else? The lab report, the thermochemistry lab report is due a week from Monday, which will be November 9. Yep. 2 plus 7 is 9. Okay. However, there is a calculation. We won't be getting to Hess's law on that. But you should review the calorimeter calculations because we'll be going through that sort of stuff in class today, and that'll be on the exam. The Hess's law stuff, combining the reactions together, I don't think we'll get to today. So that'll be next week's stuff. Right. I think that's about it. I will have a detailed answer key for this quiz up on the webpage, although I think most of you don't need it. Most of you just made silly little mistakes and otherwise did fine on it. Some of you need to practice writing chemical equations. Okay? The majority of you got that no problem, that Al2CO3 parentheses 3. Some of you had no problem with that. Some of you had serious issues with that. So if that's the case, make sure you're practicing up how to make a proper chemical formula, how to get a net ionic equation from that. That's going to be a part of the exam. So, That's it for this business, I think. You guys have questions? Well, yeah.
The stuff in the practice exams similar to the
stuff in
the exams? Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty similar. There was some differences on what was in Chapter 3 versus Chapter 4 for some of that stuff. So just you know, be careful. Have a lookout to make sure. But yeah, it's all valid stuff. So.
Is the format of the test going to be quite similar?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It'll be mostly multiple choice, a little bit of short answer, and then probably a couple of show your work problems, quiz-like stuff. Huh?
Is there any opportunities for extra credit in this class?
Not usually. The mastering chemistry, if you go through those without using the hints, it gives you a little bonus. So you can end up with a bit of a positive score from that, but otherwise, not really.
Okay.
Other questions? Well, let's continue on thermochemistry. Let's see here. Let's look at what we did last, just to get ourselves in perspective. This was calculating heat transfer, so you're introduced to these equations where Q is the amount of heat transferred, and then we multiply a change in temperature by some constant, depending if it's an object that we're dealing with. There's a heat capacity for that object. Or if it's a pure substance, or a substance that we assume is pure, we have a specific heat capacity, which is per gram of that substance, per degree Celsius. So remember, in your lab, you use both of these, right? What did you use this first equation to calculate the heat transferred to? The calorimeter itself, right? We gave you a value of the specific, of the heat capacity of the calorimeter. So even though it's styrofoam, it absorbs some heat and its temperature changes. So we use that for the calorimeter itself. Whenever we're dealing with calorimeters, a lot of times there will be a value like that that's used. Okay? Then what did we use this equation for? The specific heat capacity times a mass times the change in temperature. The surroundings? Well, the surroundings would include both the calorimeter and what this was. This was the more immediate surroundings, but the calorimeter itself was still part of the surroundings too. So the solution, right, was what we used for this. And we assumed that the solution had the specific heat capacity of water, which is an assumption that we make a lot. If something is dissolved in water, it'll take on the heat absorption capacities of water for all practical purposes, then times the mass times the change in temperature. So, so that was measuring transfers of heat. We'll come back to this after just a page or so to talk more about how this works practically. I have just one little tangent. If we're talking about a chemical reaction, which we will be an awful lot in here, right? The system very often is a chemical reaction. It will give off or absorb heat. The change in internal energy that's the total amount of energy contained within that system is the sum of Q. What's Q? Heat transferred, yeah. And heat is a transfer of energy that's in response to temperature. We tend to think of temperature as a measure of heat, but that's not right. Heat is energy that's moving from an area of high temperature to an area of low temperature. And so temperature is the more fundamental, sort of the starting thing, and heat is a transfer of energy between two areas of different temperature. Okay? So, heat transferred, and W? So, work. So, we'll talk just very briefly about work. We're not going to dwell on that engineering and thermodynamics classes and things like that deal a lot more with that. We're going to be much more interested in the heat transfer. But I will say a couple of things about work in terms of chemical reactions. The most common work a reaction would be expanding gases against an exterior pressure. So if a gas is produced in a chemical reaction, in order for that gas to take up some space, it has to push away the gases that were existing there. Or if it's in a container that moves, right, like the pistons in an engine, it has to push that piston away in order for that gas to take up space. So that's a classic definition of work, applying a force throughout a certain distance. Right? Expanding gases is often called pressure volume work, okay? Meaning that a built-up pressure will cause an increase in volume. You know, whatever container it's in, whether it's expanding a balloon or moving a piston or something like that. Okay, so the total amount of energy a reaction does, right, is involved, is quoted, I guess, by talking about the energy that's been transferred. What energy has been transferred by heat? What energy has been transferred by pushing on something? Okay, those are the two main ways that a chemical reaction can transfer energy from into or out of it. Okay? So here's a car engine. There's a combustion reaction that happens in there where the gasoline produces, gasoline produces CO2 and H2O gas. Those expanding gases is what pushes that piston away. It turns the camshaft there, and it ends up making your car move. So we talked about that a little bit before. There is also heat given off because your engine heats up and it ends up heating the air that goes through the heater when you turn the heat on. So here's an equation. We're going to use this just a little bit, that work is the negative, and it's just another weird sign convention having to do with work that was done versus work that was done on something versus work that something itself does. And that's not something we need to worry too much about. But pressure times the change in volume. Right? Whenever a gas is expanding, the amount of work done is related to the pressure that's pushing against it, like from the atmosphere, and then times the change in volume. So if I have a gas that's pushing against a cylinder like that, there's some pressure against it, and then there's some change in volume that happens. And that's all there is for calculating work. But that's not a calculation we need to do. Just have that sort of thing in the back of your head as one other way that energy is transferred. We'll be much more interested in the heat that's exchanged with the surroundings, just like what we did with the coffee cup calorimeters. We had a reaction producing heat, and the surroundings gained that certain heat. So if there is no change in volume, meaning if there's not a gas produced, or if it's open to the atmosphere, like our coffee cup calorimeter was, there's no actual measurable change in volume, even if a gas was produced. It's just released, right? So if change in volume is zero, there is no measurable work that we've done, and delta E is just Q, right? No work. So we can get a measurement of the change in energy of a system just by looking at how much heat was transferred if we set it up so that no work can be done. So that usually just means that if we have a constant volume that it's being exposed to, or if it's open to the air, well, let's not even say that. Let's just say constant volume. If it's in a sealed container, we'll talk about open to the air because that's a little bit different. But let's just say constant volume. It's in a container that's sealed. There's no change in volume that we can measure. There's just going to be heat transferred. So if P is constant, we'll use a different state function. And we'll talk about that in just a second. But let's go back to this circumstance right here, where there's just a constant volume in this reaction that we're dealing with. So calorimetry. Okay? Calor, that's a prefix that it's involved in that calorie unit. Our precision instruments that we used in lab were calorimeters. What do you suppose calor means as a Latin, I think? Latin root, what do you suppose? What does a calorimeter measure? Yeah, so calorimetry, right? Heat and metry, what's that?
Measurement,
right? So anytime there's calorimetry, that's measurement of heat. Right. This is the setup that would be used to do constant volume calorimetry. So it's called a bomb calorimeter because literally if we look at this setup here, this whole thing out here is just a water bath. So don't worry about that too much. The actual bomb calorimeter is this sort of thing here. There's a cutaway of it. And what it is, it's a machined stainless steel container that has a screw cap on it. So you unscrew it, set it aside. There's a little metal basket hanging in there that you can put a sample into. So you can put some chemical, some liquid, or some solid in there. What you do, you have a little ignition wire that you feed into the sample there. Then you seal it up, you put the cap on it really tight, you take it over, and you fill it with oxygen. So it had some air in it already, but you just hook it up to an oxygen tank and you give it really high pressure oxygen. Something like 30 atmospheres, if I'm remembering right. So that's why this has to be machined so precisely, because there's a very high pressure in there with a screw cap and you seal it down. So it's got a very large concentration of oxygen around it, an ignition wire that you put down in there. It just literally sits right in the sample, just like that, connected to these electrodes up here. So you get it all set up, you fill the outside of it with water, and you're measuring that temperature. There's a stir that keeps it all mixed up. When you're ready to go, you push a little button. It sends a charge through this ignition wire, and whatever you had in there will react with the oxygen. So you give it a little spark, you have something in there with oxygen. What kind of reaction is it called when something reacts with oxygen? Yeah, a combustion reaction. So if you put a little fuel or really anything in there, it will react with oxygen. It will combust all inside of that sealed container. If it were a larger volume or a larger amount of combustible within that sealed container, then it would literally be a bomb, right? A pipe bomb is made by having some explosive and you seal the ends down so it's closed. So when it explodes, it sends out shrapnel all over the place. That's obviously not the idea here, but it's the same sort of thing. You're doing a combustion in the sealed container. So a decent bomb calorimeter, and the school, we actually have one. It's at Coon Rapids, but a group last year brought it up here and did a project with it that was very interesting. But the bomb itself, it's a stainless steel container like that, but the thing weighs like 30 pounds. It's this little thing, but it's really heavy because it's like almost, a centimeter and a half thick steel on that thing. So it's very well constructed so it can handle a combustion inside of it. So that combustion happens. It will either give off heat or bring in heat. Combustions almost always give off heat, right? So you measure how the water outside of there, how its temperature has changed. So all of the heat in this will be transferred into the water, and this is nice and insulated on the outside. So that's a way of measuring a change in temperature that you can use to figure out how much heat was given off by that combustion. The group that did it, they were expecting to hear a boom or a bang or something like that when you push the ignition, but that thing is perfectly sealed, so you push the button, little light goes out, and that's it. It's sort of anticlimactic, but there was a tremendously violent explosion that happened inside of there that you just can't see. What did the group do? They did gasoline samples. They did diesel at diesel versus gasoline or something like that, and measured the heat of combustion for each of those. So it's pretty interesting. So let's talk about what we can do with this. Remember, delta E, change in internal energy, is heat transferred and work that's done. So work is pressure, change in volume. If change in volume is zero, inside of this bomb right here, is there any volume that's changing? I think we sealed it down. That's the volume, and that's it. So that's why this is called constant volume calorimetry. Okay. So delta E is just equal to Q. We do Q sub V to show that volume is constant. Volume is not changing. So Q is a measurable energy transfer for a certain experimental process. So we set up the bomb calorimeter, we do that, we'll be able to calculate how much heat was actually transferred within that experiment. State functions like delta E, though, are more general. They're always given for a balanced chemical equation or per mole of a substance. So Q is specific to a reaction that you actually do, so a literal amount of heat that's transferred, whereas any state function like delta E is much more general. You could do several different reactions in several different sizes, and you should be able to calculate the same sort of state function from any of those. So that should relate back to what you did in lab. You calculated a Q for your actual thing, but you did a little adjustment to make a much more general delta value that we'll talk about in a second. So Q is C cal times delta T. So you'll be given the heat capacity of the calorimeter. It's usually a separate experiment. What you actually have to do is take a certain known amount of a known substance and measure how much heat is given off by that, and you can calculate how much heat was absorbed by the calorimeter. So that's usually the first thing that you have to do in that sort of process. You have to calibrate it like that. So why do I have to do this step? Q reaction is negative Q calorimeter. What's that for? Yeah, well, the reaction and the calorimeter. What's the reaction in this? Reaction and calorimeter. One is one thing, one is the other thing.
Surroundings.
Yeah, which one's the surroundings? Calorimeter is the surroundings, the reaction is the system. So whatever is lost by the system is gained by the surroundings. So there's that sign change that has to happen. Any measurement we do is a measurement of the surroundings. But in chemistry, we're interested in what happens to the system. But it's just an opposite sign. Okay? Delta E itself is the heat transferred by the reaction divided by, what's N? Number of moles. Okay? So we'll be able to get per mole of the substance that we were doing. That's why delta E is more general. You could theoretically do this reaction with several different amounts of substance. You'd, of course, get different Qs, but if every time you're dividing by how many moles you used, you should get similar delta Es. That makes sense? Delta E is much more general. Yeah. So let's see if you can do a calculation here. So I've given you an equation. Qcal equals C, right, where the C is the heat capacity of the calorimeter times change in temperature. Do the sign change, then to get delta E, take your Q divided by N. So here's our setup. 2.14 grams of pentane, C5H12, is combusted. Temperature rises from 25.50 to 41.23. Heat capacity is 6.23 kilojoules per degree Celsius. What is delta E? So start with this first thing right up here. Okay. Start with that. Your heat capacity is already given in kilojoules, so shouldn't need to do any unit changes or anything. So What'd you guys get for delta T?
15.73.
Positive or negative? Positive, right? If we're going from 25 to 41, it gets hotter, right? Final minus initial would be positive. What is C-cal?
6.23.
Yeah. C-cal was given. Huh? Somebody get an answer for Q-cal? 98.0 what? Kilojoules. Okay. If we know Q-cal, what should I get next?
Q-R.
What's RxN stand for? Reaction. Q-reaction is equal to what? Negative. Okay. What do you have to do to, you have to divide by N, but how do you get N?
Grams.
Yep. Yep. What's the molar mass of C5H12?
72.46.
Everybody agreeing so far? Okay. So somebody get moles? We agree? 0230? Yeah? Are we agreeing so far?
Yes.
I don't have these numbers in front of me. I'm relying on you guys. It's all by it's all by consensus. Does anybody have a number so far that they didn't get?
Final answer. 3.30 times 10 to the third.
-3.30 times 10 to the third kilojoules per mole. Anybody get something different?
I got -4.30.
Times anything?
10 to the
negative. 10 to the negative third?
All right, I mean.
Positive third? Okay.
I got the first one.
First one? You're getting more votes for the first one than the second one. Probably just typed something in wrong. That looks. Getting that? Okay. So, that's hopefully not a tremendously difficult calculation to do. The hard part in this is that on.
Yeah.
You're a 4 now?
Later, but retarded or something.
So,
no, I typed it in.
It was 4.
I
twice.
Was like 0.03.
Ah.
Okay.
Yeah. 0.023. Do I have to type this in too?
4.260.
Professor
Yeah,
Wow.
Yeah,
multiple
0.02966.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was rounded a little more. Okay. Well, if we do 97.99, yeah. In fact, let's not round this value because we're not done with it. Let's do 97.9979, right? Okay. Thank you. That's better. Okay, 2.14 divided by, is 72.146 the right molar mass?
Yes.
Okay. 0.2966. All right. So I do 97.9979 divided by 0.02966. Okay. I got 3304.04. So what's all these four? What's all these 4 points?
Well, 98 divided by 0.023 actually.
Ah, if you'd used the rounded value,
so
I see.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the problem. Yeah. So what mistake were we making? Yeah. Rounding too early, right? 97.9979. Right? So 3.30.
The thing is that the two moles are so different that when you're dividing by a decimal number, it's going to just shoot out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're dividing by such a small number like that, if you do a rounding where you're not supposed to, that blows your answer away. Okay. So what's best to do if you have a calculator that can store all these numbers in, it shouldn't matter what you're writing down on the page. You just use the numbers that are stored in your calculator.
Is it supposed to be negative?
Yep. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
And it's not 3.30.
Did I round it wrong?
Because it's 3371. Because it's not 0.023.
Oh, 2966. You're right. Well, that'll teach me to trust you guys to give me the values.
I told you it was a mistake.
Good grief. All right.
So that guy was...
Yeah. What?
So, okay.
All right. Now are we happy?
Now we forgot how to do it.
Yeah. Now how does it? What was the question? So, really, doing the math on this really shouldn't be the hard part. What will be a little challenging about this is that on the first page of the exam, you'll be given a list of equations. You have to figure out what equation it is to use. So, when you're given something that's in kilojoules per degree Celsius, okay, that means you're going to use the equation where all you're doing is multiplying by a change in temperature. If you have kilograms or gram, or kilojoules per gram per degree Celsius, what also has to be multiplied in there? Yeah, a mass. So that would be a specific heat capacity for something like water or something. But when we have a calorimeter like this, there is a separate experiment done just to determine how much heat overall, the water and the calorimeter and everything, how much heat that whole thing absorbs for a certain change in temperature. Okay? Good? So, all right. Let's talk about delta H. Delta H is what you calculated at the end of lab last time. So it's going to be important that we know why the bomb calorimeter gave us a delta E and why our coffee cup gave us a delta H. So it's all this right here. It's more convenient to do a reaction open to the atmosphere where pressure is constant. Okay? Even though you put the little cardboard lid on it, that was still open to the atmosphere, right? There was no pressure being built up in that coffee cup calorimeter. Okay? So, and I think you'll agree that was pretty convenient to do it that way. It's a whole big production, screwing the cap down on there and loading it with oxygen. And that. So much easier to use a coffee cup. So the heat exchange in a specific experiment is QP, and its related state function for a general process is called delta H. So when pressure is constant, what did I call Q for the bomb calorimeter where volume was constant? What did I call it? QV. This is different. This is QP where pressure is constant. So there's going to be some work done. It's not something we can really measure, but there's going to be work done that's pushing the atmosphere away from it, especially if there's a gas that's formed. If there's not a gas formed, though, it's going to be pretty much the same as our other state function, delta E. But even so, we use this term delta H. It's called change in enthalpy. The delta H, it probably originally stood for heat or something like that. But this word enthalpy, it's just energy. It's just a change in internal energy that does not count work. So it's the change in internal energy only related to heat transfer, not related to work that's been done. So we're essentially leaving out the work term and saying that what we have now is just called delta H. So it behaves, though, the same way that delta E does. It's still a state function of that internal system. So in terms of it giving off heat or bringing in heat, we can talk specifically. So it only involves the heat given off or absorbed. It has the same signs as Q. Okay? So, and it's the signs of delta E and stuff, that was weird. But this is easy. We'll be able to get this, especially when we think about these two types of reactions, endothermic and exothermic. So, endothermic reaction, heat is transferred from the surroundings to the system. So, say you're holding in your hand a reaction which is endothermic. Heat is being transferred from the surroundings into the system. So what will that feel like in your hand? Yeah, that'll feel cold. Remember last time I said there is no such thing as cold, it's just heat that's been transferred away from your hands or whatever. Okay? So if we're thinking in terms of the system, delta H is always in the system. Okay. Let's see if we can figure out what the sign of delta H for that will be. Did the system gain energy or did the system lose energy? Gain. System gained energy. So a gain in energy should be what sign? Yeah, delta H is positive. And students tend to have no problem with this as long as you remember you're thinking about the system. You're not thinking about your hand or the beaker or the water that's in the beaker. You're thinking about the actual reaction itself. Exothermic, heat is transferred from the system to the surroundings. You have an exothermic reaction in your hand. What will that feel like? Yeah. And the sign of delta H will be what? Negative. Why is delta H negative for a reaction that feels hot? Yeah, because the system is losing energy. It's going out from the system. Okay? So there's a good little picture in the book here. I mentioned the chemical ice pack earlier, but that behaves in a way that we can talk about here. If something feels cold, that means the energy is being transferred as heat from the surroundings into the system itself. So it's pulling heat, it's pulling energy out of your hand, it's pulling energy out of the liquid that is inside of the pack. Okay? It's pulling that energy into the actual chemical reaction itself. Flames are exothermic. That one's usually easier to picture because you've got a reaction that's going on, it's given off heat, and you can feel that heat that's been given off. Okay? So everybody able to identify endothermic and exothermic? What does exo mean? Outwards. Okay. In biology, an exoskeleton is is the hard shell that a bug has outside of its guts, right? Endo means into, right? Or inside. So it's all about the direction that heat is transferred. Whenever we have a delta H, it is always given per a balanced chemical equation. We said that in lab. A delta H just alone by itself is meaningless. It always has to be given for a certain amount of something. Okay? That's because delta H is, see if you guys can remember this. Delta H is a property that is dependent on how much of the substance there is. Anybody remember what that's called? Yeah, that's what it depends on. It when a property depends on how much is there, what is that property called? What
state?
It's a state function is anything that can have a delta in front of it. It's the opposite of density. Does density depend on how much you have? No. Remember what kind of function, what kind of property density was? Remember that word? Intensive. Density was intensive. So something like this that does depend on how much it is called what? Extensive, right? It's an extensive. It's good. Depends on the amount of the substance we have. The simplest extensive properties are things like mass and volume, which, of course, the more stuff you have, the more mass you have. But think of it similarly to here. If you have, if you're talking about a large amount of substance, you'll have a greater delta H as opposed to a smaller. So delta H is always given. You always show how much substance you're talking about. So it's always written right next to a balanced chemical equation. So let's talk about what a thermochemical equation is. It's just looks like a regular balanced chemical equation. It will have a thermochemical state function listed after it. So delta H is the most common one we use because it's the easiest to measure. Delta E requires a bomb calorimeter, something like that. It uses the molar interpretation. So the coefficients that we see in the balanced equation are the number of moles that we're talking about. So when I have this one right here, how many moles of water have I produced if I'm interpreting this molar? This is actually 2 moles of water. And for 2 moles of hydrogen reacting with 1 mole of oxygen. If I produce 2 moles of water, this is the amount of heat that's transferred. Okay? So this is 4. Does that make sense? When you see a thermochemical equation, you see a balanced chemical equation with a delta H behind it, that right there is per however many moles of whatever it is you're talking about are listed right there. So let's see if you guys get that. How much heat is given off when 20 grams of hydrogen react with excess oxygen? What do you suppose you ought to convert those grams of hydrogen into? 2.016, right? Okay. But you don't need to get an answer just right there. Use our delta H right here and use how many moles of hydrogen that delta H is per. So our delta H is minus 483.7 kilojoules. But what is that per? Yeah, right over here. I asked about 20 grams of hydrogen. This number over here is per 2 moles. Right? Right there. So
in a problem like this, that delta H reaction will be given?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Delta H's will be given, and they'll be given next to a chemical reaction, or they could be given per mole of a substance. Okay? So just in your head, what would be kilojoules per mole of hydrogen? How would that relate to this 483 number? If it's 483 kilojoules per 2 moles, yeah, it'd be like 242 kilojoules per mole. So it could be given per mole of a substance, or it could be just given as kilojoules for this equation, for however many moles you see on those. Does that make sense?
And then if it was So it would specify if it was for more than whichever one.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Really, the only time these are listed as just kilojoules is when it's standing next to this balanced equation. It could be, we could have said minus 483.7 kilojoules per mole of O2, right, if we were asked about that, because that's for one. Okay? So, who would like to give me a correctly rounded answer? Pressure's on, right? Agree? Disagree?
Agree.
Okay, good. All right. This is something that's okay to list just as kilojoules because it's referring to this specific circumstance. How much heat in kilojoules is given off when I react 20 grams of hydrogen? That's that many kilojoules. Okay? All right. Well, now it's time to talk about our precision calorimeters that we use. Delta H can be measured with a constant pressure calorimeter. That sounds much more official than two nested coffee cups. Right? Constant pressure calorimeter. Right. So this is exactly what you had, a thermometer. Well, your thermometer and stirrer were the same thing. Right? That's okay. Loose-fitting lid, some styrofoam cups with the reactants. We have to make some important assumptions when we're using this, though. Okay? And we talked a little bit about those in lab, and you included those in your calculations. But first of all, let's assume all the heat is gained by the solution, okay? Or if it's heat gained by the reaction, would be lost by the solution. But what we normally assume, and what this textbook does, this assumes that all of the heat just goes into the solution itself. In your lab, we gave you that 10 joules per degree Celsius as the value for the coffee cups themselves. But a lot of times, especially if there's a large amount of heat given off, a lot of times that can just be neglected without making much of a difference. So in your lab, if you're ever given the value for the coffee cups themselves, you add that in. But most of the time, and if it's something on the exam, the heat gained by the styrofoam itself is something we can usually ignore. Okay? So we'll assume all the heat is gained by the solution. Since there's a varying amount of solution, we use its specific heat capacity. That's the thing that's per grams. Okay. So our book uses C sub S. Our experiment used S. So here's the reaction. Q, heat that was gained or lost by the solution, is mass of the solution times specific heat capacity times change in temperature. And let's just get these grams right. Or get these units, right? Mass would be in grams. Change of temperature would be in degrees Celsius. So this would be in joules or kilojoules. Joules per what? Per gram per degree Celsius. Okay? Could be in either order, but it's per both of those.
Would you say it like that? Joules per gram per degree Celsius?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Or you could say joules per gram degree Celsius. It's the same thing. Now, both of these are in the bottom of the fraction.
Oh,
it's per both of those. Yeah. So, yeah. So, it has both, and we've done enough unit analysis by now to realize both of these have to be on the bottom of that fraction to cancel with these units that are up there. Okay? So, if that's Q solution, if that's the heat transferred in terms of the solution, what do I do to get heat transferred by the reaction? Negative. Right? It's negative all that. Negative mass times C sub S times delta T. So you get an answer for that. You change the sign to be talking about the reaction. Let's list the assumptions that we normally make if it's a dilute aqueous solution. We'll say that the specific heat capacity for the solution is the same as water. That's an assumption we made in lab. Because it's 99.9% water. There's just a little bit of other stuff dissolved in it. So it has all the same heat transfer properties as just water. So we made that assumption in lab. Okay. a lot of times what we can do is assume that the mass of the solution is just the mass of that same amount of water. What you actually did in lab, you actually put it on the balance and measured the mass, but you probably would have gotten the same answer if you would have just assumed that same mass of water, right? And that being the case, the density of the solution would be 1 gram per milliliter. So if you were told that you added 15 milliliters of HCl to 20 milliliters of NaOH, and both of these are some solutions with molarities, what would we assume that the mass of the solution would be? 35 what? Does that make sense? Anybody good with that? So, as long as it's a dilute solution, which they will be on any exam question or anything that you would see, that's a safe assumption to make. Okay? Let's see if we can do this. First step, I've given you two solutions that were added together, 50 mils of 0.5 omolar sulfuric acid, added to 20 mils of 0.5 omolar sodium hydroxide in a coffee cup. I told you what the temperature changed to. I'm telling you you can assume specific heat capacity to be that of water. You can make those other same assumptions that we talked about before. So what I want to have here is Q solution. I want to have Q reaction then. Okay? See if we can do that.
We're being serenaded.
It is. It's actually very nice.
Look at that. So it's a little quieter. It's soothing.
I
don't know. Okay? So, use the equations we have on the last page. Don't need to do too much with the mechanics of the reaction just yet. We'll do that in the next part. All I need is the mass and the change in temperature and the specific heat capacity.
What's delta T for this one? Okay. Even before I write down an answer for this, what could I write down in order to get this into the unit I want, kilojoules? Mm-hmm. Yeah, might as well just do that. 1 kilojoule per 1,000 joules. Will Q solution be a positive or a negative value? Mm-hmm. Based on the temperature change right there, does that make sense that Q is positive for the solution? Because what happened to the solution? Yeah, it went higher in temperature. Okay? It's positive because the solution gained heat. So Somebody get an answer in kilojoules? 0.639, 2.586. What else?
0.644.
0.644. Hear more of that one. As we learned before, the more popular answer isn't necessarily the correct one, though.
One
more user error here. I mean, this isn't too tough arithmetic. If I do 70 times 4.184 times 2.2 divided by 1,000, I got 0.644336. What?
Kilojoules.
Q, reaction. let's just underline that 4 so we know it's only good to 3 significant figures, but we're going to use this, so I'm going to keep those extra numbers. All right? Now, let's use that value. We're not done yet. There's our Q reaction. That's how much heat was actually transferred that we measured for that particular reaction. I want to know what delta H is for this following balanced chemical equation. This is exactly what we did in lab. You measured a Q for your reaction, but you had to convert it a little bit in order to get a general delta H. And for that, we need to find the limiting reactant. So you have given amounts. When you have volumes and molarities, what do you convert into? Well, molarity is moles per liter. What can I get whenever I have a volume and a molarity? I can get moles. So start out your conversions with each of those getting moles. Okay, I would convert into moles of one of the products. It doesn't matter. Right? But use a mole ratio to get yourself over into one of those two products. So you can pick whichever one you want. It doesn't matter. I'll do that one. But you start out writing that down. Start out a conversion with H2SO4, for instance. And convert that into moles of one of the products based on this chemical equation. It's important to figure out limiting reactant because this amount of heat transferred is based on how much actually reacted. One of those is going to be in excess, and that doesn't contribute to heat produced or anything. So we have to figure out what it is that actually did react. So, like I said, it doesn't matter which product you're converting into as long as you're converting into the same product for both of the ones you're starting with. Our point from this is just figuring out which one is the limiting reactant, right? You can, right, here's what I'm converting into.
NaSO4.
Yeah, I just chose that one. You could choose to convert into H2O. It doesn't matter. Okay? But you have to do the same thing for all of your calculations. Right? Times. Okay. Who knows which one is the limiting reactant here?
Any
of which? Did anybody convert into moles of H2O? We should have somebody that converts into moles of H2O. Oh, no. That's all right. It would have just been twice these values, right? It would have been 0.05 and 0.01. How do I know which one is the limiting reactant based on this? The one which produces the smallest amount of product, right? Because this 0.025 cannot be produced. As soon as I produce this smaller amount, then the limiting reactant runs out. Okay. Why do I need that? Because to get delta H, I have to be dividing by number of moles of the limiting reactant itself. So I got moles of product produced here. Right. How am I going to get how many moles of limiting reactant? Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I got moles of sodium sulfate, right, there are 2 moles of sodium hydroxide for every 1 mole of that. So you could set up another conversion, go back to it, or you could just start with this one and just stop the calculation right when you get to moles. Right there. I think that's actually a little more straightforward sometimes. So if I did 20 divided by 1,000 times 0.5, it should end up being twice that, right? Yeah. 0.01. And maybe for practicing this, maybe you ought to retry this sometime later, calculating it out for water, just to see that you get the same answer either way. It's the same thing as the limiting reactant. But did anybody want to check my numbers? Is that 0.01 moles NaOH correct for the moles of limiting reactant? Okay. I'm not right on rounding, but it's just going to be trailing zeros after that. So we just won't use this to limit anything. So here's our key. We did this exact same thing in lab on Monday. Remember this? Nah, I don't remember this. I had this written up on the board anyway, where delta H is the coefficient of the limiting reactant, which in this case is what? 2. We have to do that because the delta H in this reaction is going to be representing 2 moles of sodium hydroxide. If I left that out, I would just be doing it for 1 mole of sodium hydroxide because I'd be dividing by how many I actually used. So we need that. Okay? What was Q reaction? That was up here, right? Negative 0.0644.
Negative 0.644.
336 Q. Kilojoules. Okay. What is NLR? And in fact, this coefficient, since it's the molar interpretation, what does that 2 actually stand for? 2 what? Yeah, let's actually do that. So. Our answer is good to how many significant figures?
Three.
Three? So, what'd you get? How many?
Negative
258
kilograms.
And 258?
129.
Or what? Yeah. Well, we did. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I thought. I got minus. Is that better? You got 200, you multiplied by 2 twice. Okay? So, the equations that we used here, for instance, these ones, like Q equals MCS delta T. I won't say solution on the exam. It'll be Q surroundings equals MCS delta T and Q system equals negative Q surroundings. That's the generalized version of that. So something like that will appear on the exam. Okay? I will give that to you. You have to know what that means, of course, but don't need to memorize it. I will also give you this. Oops. I guess I don't need a box around that. Where delta H for a reaction is the coefficient of the limiting reactant times Q of the reaction divided by the moles of limiting reactant that were actually used in that experiment. So let's back up and make sure we understand the steps to this here. So this was the question set up that you would be given. For instance, you're mixing things together in a calorimeter. Some reaction happens. You're told of a temperature change. You'll usually be told what to assume the specific heat capacity. The first thing you do is figure out Q. Just using that regular, we call it the calorimeter equation. Q equals mass times specific heat times change in temperature. That tells you how much heat was transferred away from the reaction. Then, to make it more general for any time anyone would run that reaction, not just with the specific amounts you did, you find the limiting reactant. So you'll be given a balanced chemical equation for this. And you have to be given the balanced chemical equation because you have to see what the actual coefficients are. If I had chose to balance this a little differently, if I did 2-4-2-4, in thermochemical equations, that's not forbidden, but my final answer would be twice what it is there. So because instead of 2 moles of sodium hydroxide, I'd be talking about 4 moles of sodium hydroxide. I could have given you an equation that said 1/2, 1/2. And 1. In that case, we'd just be talking about 1 mole of sodium hydroxide. So the value we get for delta H depends on how the balanced chemical equation was specifically written. So that's why we have to take this coefficient into account. That gets multiplied by whatever we would get per mole. I don't want centrifuges. Okay, so we took the stuff we were given. If there are 2 solutions you add together, use the molarity to get moles, then a mole ratio to go into one of the products. Doesn't matter which one, but do the same one for both. Right? I discard the larger one, keep the small one, because that shows me this was the limiting reactant. Then moles of that limiting reactant is our NLR. That's how many moles actually reacted that we can use. That we can use for this. So this many kilojoules were given off per that many moles that were actually reacting. That's what happens. That's how we get kilojoules per mole, essentially. Then we multiply by the coefficient to set it up for this particular equation. Okay? So, you guys have questions on that? Yes?
So, for a test, would it just give us all these numbers at the top and we say find delta A to the reaction?
Yep.
Would it be like A times omega in reaction and form B?
It would pretty much look exactly like this without the blue things that I put in here. So all this black stuff, this would be part A of one that you would have to write out, for instance. This, what is delta H for the following, along with this balanced chemical equation, that would be part B. Okay. The other stuff I had here, find the limiting reactant, what is NLR, that's hints for us now in what you actually have to do, but this sort of thing would not be there on an exam. So, this thing in the box here would be on an equation sheet on the front of the exam or something like that. Okay. So, that's equation. No.
You just have to know which ones to use in which situation.
Yeah, it's very important that you practice it enough to know that you need to have specific heat capacity, for instance, one with mass in it. Okay. So that, for instance, will be given on exam, as well as the other one, where it's just Q surroundings equals C delta T for the regular heat capacity.
So the specific heat capacity for the solution, so whatever it is on the exam, will be given?
Yeah, that'll be given. It'll usually be that of water, so it'll usually be 4.184, but even so, it'll be given to you. Okay? I don't think I need to show you anything else. Nope, Hess's Law is after that, so that's what we needed to get through. So please, in the mass screen chemistry, there's at least a couple of opportunities to practice pretty much this exact calculation. Please do that before the exam. In your assigned textbook problems, there are plenty of ways to practice this sort of thing, not only with solutions, but maybe with a solid that you added, like in lab, for instance. Practice something like that, but in the assigned textbook problems, there are plenty of opportunities to practice that too. Mm-hmm. So that is the extent to which this chapter will be covered on the exam. The other stuff we'll do after it. Okay? So, see you. I'm sorry? In this one, we added two liquid solutions together. In lab, we added solid.
Okay, so kind of
it's pretty much exactly the same, except you just do grams and a molar mass here. And the grams of solid that you have would just be added to the grams of liquid.
I didn't think you heard what I said.
Up above. That's if it's a solution like this, right?
Oh, no.
So if you have 20 grams, it's 20 grams. But then if you have 5 grams, it's 25 grams.
Okay, so you wouldn't have to change that.
All right.